Okay, so this is Bio 231, and it is Wednesday, January 26th. We're going to finish up cells. That's chapter 2. So does anybody have any questions? What about your pre-lecture reading assignments? Oh, did the microphone? No, I still hear it. Okay. What about your pre-lecture reading assignments? Any questions on those? You're working on those. Don't let those pile up. They're best to do before lecture, not before the test. All right, and probably if you've used them, you'd notice that they're pretty easy to get through. So if you're at that level before lecture, that's great. That will make lecture a lot easier to understand. But if you're at that level before the test, that's not going to help you very much, right? You got to get a little bit beyond that. Okay, but you got good study materials in Blackboard, all those practice quizzes and interactive exercises that will really help you with the tests. All right, last time we ended talking about transport between or across the cell membrane. And then I was looking at some notes and I noticed that I kind of slighted one topic when it came to the nucleus, and I want to go back and talk about that a little bit because there might be some questions, I think, online questions regarding this. All right, so here we got an organelle, which is the nucleus. Inside the nucleus we have genetic material. And that genetic material is made from nucleic acids, and that makes DNA. And when the cell is in interphase, it's using that DNA to make proteins. And we're going to talk about protein synthesis at the end of this chapter. All right, so it uses genetic information to make proteins. It tells the cell how to make particular proteins. The nucleus is the active part of the nucleus. It's making stuff that we call RNA, which is a necessary step for making a protein. Okay, but I want to talk a little bit about how chromosomes are formed. Chromosomes are not just DNA or nucleic acid. They actually are made with proteins as well. Okay, so here is what a nucleic acid looks like. It just has two strands of nucleotides that forms a really long string of a molecule. And if we were to take all of the DNA in your body from all the cells, it's so long, and string this DNA molecule one after the other. Remember, you got 46 chromosomes all made out of DNA. If you string all 46 of those chromosomes from all the cells of your body, you're going to have about 250,000 miles worth of DNA, which is enough to get from the Earth to the Moon. So that's a huge molecule if you're added all together. So there's a lot of information that can be coded in DNA. And as you can imagine, if you have something that's microscopically thin and that long, it's very easy to break. And once you break a DNA, then the information is lost. It's worthless. So it's very important to be able to package DNA to keep it safe. And the way that cells do that, okay, is that it wraps it up around different kinds of proteins when it's not being used. And those proteins are what we call histones right here. So here we can see a double-stranded DNA molecule, which carries all the information on how to build your body. And when it's not being used, you can see it wrapped around histone proteins. So a chromosome is part DNA and also part protein as well. And if we take a bunch of these histones and wrap DNA around it, it forms a little structure right here. We call that a nucleosome. And then even nucleosomes form a coil, a supercoil, and then that actually what makes up a chromosome. And if once DNA that's been all extended like this or strung out gets wrapped up, we say that it is condensed. And condensed DNA is something that we can actually see underneath a microscope, and that's how we observe the different phases of mitosis in lab. Okay, looking at condensed chromatin, that means chromatin wrapped around these histone molecules to make it what? A much thicker kind of molecule that you can actually see with your eye through a light microscope. But chromatin is so thin, even a light microscope, you can't see that, so that during interphase, when the DNA is being used within the cell to make proteins, the nucleus just looks very homogeneous. You don't see any chromosomes. You just see that it has a certain darkness or picked up a certain amount of stain that has a certain kind of color. So this right here, we call this extended chromatin. It can be used. And when it forms a chromosome that you can actually see right here, that is condensed chromatin, and it's in a nice safe configuration, but it can't be used for anything, right? And during mitosis, you notice that the nuclear envelope disappears, So at that point in time, the DNA is vulnerable for being broken or attacked by different kinds of molecules, but it's okay because it is condensed into chromosomes and it's safe during that process of mitosis as a result. So when you look at chromatin in the form of a chromosome, meaning that it's condensed, the way that I kind of think about that is when you go on a trip someplace, maybe for a week, you're going to go down to the Caribbean for a vacation, okay? And you just go just with the clothes you're wearing, or what do you take with you? You probably take at least your wallet and one credit card, but probably a lot more than that. Maybe your cell phone, okay? And what else? Maybe your flippers because you're going to do some scuba diving or snorkeling or something. And you got a mask and a toothbrush and what else? A comb, different kinds of clothes, shoes, sandals. All right, so when you're walking on an airplane, do you have all that stuff in your arms? What do you do with it so that it's protected and so that you don't lose it? You put it in a suitcase, right? So it's all protected, you don't lose it. But if it's in the suitcase, can you use it? No, in order to use it, you got to get it out. So think of a chromosome like this, where all the chromatin is condensed, that's all the good stuff packaged in a way like in a suitcase where it's protected, where it can't get lost. But if it's going to be used to make proteins, you got to take it out of the suitcase, namely in this particular circumstance, we say it's got to be extended. Right, extended chromatin is a way that that information can be used, accessed to make a protein out of it. But what's the trade-off? If it's in this very long filamentous fiber, just like if you were to walk on an airplane with 50 different things just in your arms and hands, you could lose it. And then once you lose a comb, then you can't comb your hair, right? If you lose a part of that DNA, then it can't be used by a cell. But unfortunately, the cell might die as a result of that. Okay, so that's the big difference, okay, between condensed and extended chromatin. And histones are just proteins that help protect DNA when it's in a condensed form. Okay, so let's get back to talking about movement across the plasma membrane, unless you got a question. Any questions so far? No, you're doing pretty good. Okay, so remember when we were talking about transport processes, there are two main transport processes. There is active and passive. Passive just means that it's going to happen automatically. Active means that you have to expend energy in order for that process to take place. And we're kind of done talking about passive processes, I think. Doesn't require any energy. What is the energy molecule inside your body? And what organelle produces it? ATP is the universal energy carrier in your body. And there's an organelle that takes all different kinds of energy molecules and converts it into ATP, which everything can understand inside the cell, which is the mitochondria. That's the job of the mitochondria. Okay. All right, so to think of transport processes, sometimes I think of when I was in college, I had a really fancy car. It was really expensive, was really exotic. It was an MGB, and it was about this long. It was really sporty, but it wouldn't always start, okay? So it wasn't really all that expensive, I suppose. But since it was so small, and it was sporty, so it had a manual shift in it, right? And sometimes the battery was dead, sometimes the starter motor wasn't working, right? Or all kinds of different things that was going wrong with it. So when I would park the car, guess where I would park my car to get it started? All right, here we have something, okay? Maybe I got to find a marker that works right here. This is what we call a hill. Okay, so I would have my car. That marker kind of works too, a little bit. Here's one. I'm sure this is going to work. So I would take my car and park it on top of the hill right here, because even if the battery was dead, I could get my car started. How would I do that? I could, yeah, push it just a little bit because it was a little dinky car, my left foot out the door, get it rolling down the hill, and then I would pop the clutch, right, and get the engine started. All right, so rolling down the hill, do I need to have gasoline in the car? Do I have to have a live battery? No, that's a, so what kind of process is that rolling down the hill? Is that active or passive? That's passive, right? So going down is a passive process. So I'm going to relate this to diffusion for you. So going from high to low is a passive process. Now, what about having this car down here at the bottom of the hill going up. Is that passive or active? That's an active process, right? You need to have that battery well charged, or better yet, have some gasoline in the fuel tank, right? And turn the engine on, and then you can use the gasoline to get up the hill. So going from low to high requires energy. That's an active process. So just use that analogy to understand diffusion as well. But in diffusion, you're going to think of concentrations, not just elevations in space, right? So going from low concentration to high concentration, it's possible for molecules to do that. But if they are going to do that, what has to happen? There has to be gasoline, and what's the form of gasoline in your body? ATP, right? There's got to be ATP available to move molecules from low concentration to high concentration. But molecules will move all by themselves from high to low, down the concentration gradient. So if we look at this slide over here on the left, we're going to finish up by talking about active processes, requires energy, and of course you could write in what that energy is, right? That's ATP. And it is a way for molecules to go from low to high concentration. All right, so here we have an ATP molecule, and what that stands for is adenosine triphosphate. So on this molecule, there are three phosphate atoms. Phosphorus is a kind of element, and if we were to take one of those phosphates off of this adenosine molecule, it becomes adenosine diphosphate. There are two phosphates left, and there's one phosphate then that's floating around in solution someplace. And there was a chemical bond that attached this third phosphate to adenosine, and when that bond is broken, that energy becomes released. And it can be used by different processes inside the body. So when ATP is broken down into ADP, what does that D stand for? Di means there's two phosphates left on that molecule. There's energy available to move things, right, in order to do work. Maybe move things from low concentration to high, because what does it require to go from low to high? Energy, and it gets it from ATP. All right, but then you lose ATP when that happens. Okay, now how much, you should get an appreciation for how much ATP your body really requires. And there's two ways that I think about that. ATP is made by mitochondria, and the mitochondria need oxygen in order to make ATP. That's why you inhale all the time to get oxygen inside your body. And then it gets absorbed by the blood, and the blood takes oxygen to your brain, and all those mitochondria in your brain make ATP so that you can remain conscious, so that you can think and process information and things like that. But as soon as you cut off oxygen to the brain, those mitochondria stop making ATP, right? So my question is, if we cut off oxygen to the brain, when do you lose consciousness because, or how much time elapses before you lose consciousness because the mitochondria can't make ATP and you need that ATP to stay awake? What's that period of time when blood stops going to your brain? How much time of consciousness do you have? Okay, maybe if you've taken a CPR class or something, maybe you know, but it is about 3 seconds. And then your brain runs out of oxygen, the mitochondria shut down, your brain uses up all the ATP, and then you just faint. Okay. But in order to stay alive, not just think, in order to stay alive, you need ATP. So if the mitochondria aren't making ATP in your brain, the brain is going to die as a result of that. So first you become unconscious, and then your brain dies. What period of time does your brain die after oxygen is shut off? Okay. Yeah, 4 minutes is a really good guess, but it's just use the same number, 3 minutes. So 3 seconds, you'll become unconscious. After 3 minutes, the brain dies. And once something dies, like your brain, guess what happens? Can it ever come back? No, dead is like an irreversible process, right? So that's why CPR is so important. When somebody's heart stops, blood stops going to their brain, you need somebody to assist your heart pumping by doing chest compressions, and you can get enough oxygen in the brain, they probably won't wake up, but it's enough to preserve that brain tissue from death until they get to a hospital and somebody can revive their heart form, right? So that's really good. So you got 3 seconds worth of ATP in your brain. That's how important it is. Another way that I think about the importance of ATP is that since it has to be broken down in order to release that energy, how much ATP at one time would you have to have, like in a suitcase, in order to stay alive all day long in terms of a weight? How much ATP would you have to have? All right, and the answer is, if you think of the weight of a normal person as being about 70 kilograms, we don't really know what a kilogram is, but that's a textbook figure for the weight of an average person, male or female, all averaged together. You need 40 kilograms of ATP a day to stay alive, which is what? More than half your body weight. So that's a huge amount of ATP, that's a huge amount of gasoline that your body has to use up every day. Fortunately, as soon as ATP is broken down and there's oxygen and you have healthy mitochondria, guess what they do? They build it back up again. They make ATP. So ATP is being broken down, mitochondria build it back up. So you don't need to have 40 kilograms at any 1 second, but over a period of a day, that's how much ATP is produced by mitochondria and how much you break down. So that's a very important molecule because it's used for transport processes, regulating how things move across the cell membrane. Okay. So some of the active transports processes are what we call molecular transport, just moving ions from one side of a molecule to another. And if it's going from low concentration to high, like another model that you could have in your mind, let's just say that we have some water down here in the ground, and here you are in your tent camping out someplace, and you want to get to this water that's underground because your canteens are low on water, right? There's a little pipe that goes down into this aquifer right here, and I can't even draw this thing very well, okay? But there's something up on the surface right here that you walk up to, and what do you got to do with that little handle? You have to pump it, right? So we use that as a way to describe various proteins in a membrane that can move molecules from low concentration to high concentration across the membrane. We call those pumps. They're called, and they use ATP, so sometimes we call those ATP pumps as a result. And they can pump different ions or molecules across the cell membrane. Now, some things are too big to move across the membrane just by using a pump, like maybe cells or fragments of cells, and so we need macromolecular transport to do that. And it can move still particles from low to high. So if it's from low to high, what kind of transport process is that? It's still going to be active. Oh, I got to click. It's still going to be an active process. But macromolecular transport happens with this kind of process. So for instance, here's a plasma membrane if we look on the right-hand side. And the cell wants to take in all of these particles right here. It can form a dimple, this invagination inside the cytoplasm. And when it does, the fluid from the extracellular side of the membrane can fill into this little space right here. And remember, the way that we think about a membrane right here is the fluid mosaic model. So this membrane is very fluid. It can change shape very easily, but there are microtubules that will pull and push on the membrane to form this little bubble. And eventually it pinches off and the bubble then moves away from the cell membrane. But when it does, then it carries with it inside that vesicle things that were where? In the extracellular fluid right here. All right. Now this can't happen automatically by itself. It requires ATP to do that. So it's an active process. These molecules can go from low concentration to high. That's fine because there's ATP available. And if these particles right here are a fluid, we call that pinocytosis. That just literally means cell drinking. So even fluid can be taken up by cells. Okay. If these particles right here are solid particles, it could even be parts of bacteria or viruses, for instance, right? Solid particles, then we call that phagocytosis. Phagocytosis just means cell eating as opposed to cell drinking. So if it's a solid particle, it's phagocytosis. If it's a fluid, it's pinocytosis. Okay? And if it's the movement of particles inside the cell, we call that endocytosis. So phagocytosis and pinocytosis are both parts of endocytosis. And the reverse of that can happen too. So there are things inside the cell that the cell produces via maybe the rough endoplasmic reticulum. What's the job of rough ER? And what does it make? Just a bullet point for rough ER. Protein synthesis, right. So rough ER makes protein synthesis that is destined to be secreted outside the cell. Sometimes those proteins end up in a Golgi apparatus. What's the job of Golgi apparatus? modifying and packaging. So modifies that protein into some kind of sugar protein or lipid protein, packages it into a vesicle, which then moves over to the cell membrane, and it fuses with the cell membrane, and whatever inside that vesicle then gets exocytosed into the extracellular environment, or secreted, right? And again, that requires ATP, because these vesicles have to hop a ride on a microtubule, and it's got to move these things around. Just like if you get on a bus someplace, or even get a ride in your car, you got to pay for it with gasoline, right? Or dollars or something. Okay, so those are macromolecular transport processes across the cell membrane. Okay, any questions on that so far? Okay, just remember, high to low is what kind of process? Passive. Low to high is active. And how does your cell pay for things? It's in the form of ATP. And you got to know the organelle that makes ATP for us. That's mitochondria, and mitochondria need oxygen as well as other fuel molecules to make ATP for us. All right, and you need a tremendous amount of ATP all day long. Oh, how much did I say? How much ATP do you need in a day? Yeah, 40 kilograms. Okay, 40, not all at one time, but that's how much your body has to make those mitochondria. Ah, let me just say one last thing about these mitochondria. Your book kind of alludes to this a little bit. Okay, let's go back to this diagram right here of the cell. So here's that mitochondria, membranes inside membranes. And if you look at this mitochondria after you take a microbiology class, it's going to be really obvious to you that this mitochondria right here really looks like a bacterium, a bacillus bacterium. And if you got a really fancy microscope, you can even look inside this mitochondria right here and you can find DNA, just like your cell has DNA to control its function and to design its structure. There is DNA inside a mitochondria that defines its structure and how a mitochondria functions. When a cell undergoes mitosis, mitochondria don't necessarily undergo mitosis. They control their own rate of duplication inside the cell depending on its own DNA inside of it. So you could actually think of mitochondria, which is all agreed upon as an organelle producing ATP for us, you could actually think of that as a bacteria that has learned to live inside of this cell right here. So a human cell is really a symbiotic organism, part this prokaryotic cell that has a nucleus plus this bacteria that at one point in time, millions or billions of years ago, infected this cell line, and they learned to live together under symbiotic conditions. And when we say symbiosis, what do we mean by that? That's a big fancy term. You maybe not have heard of symbiosis before. Yeah, but it's when two organisms share the same environment, they live together, and they both produce beneficial things for each other. So they both get something out of the relationship. One doesn't just live off of the other. One is not a parasite. They both contribute, so they both can live. All right, well, it's easy to see what this eukaryotic cell, the human cell, gets from a mitochondria. I would not want to give up my mitochondria because what do they give me? Ooh, not oxygen. They give me ATP. Yeah, I love ATP. My brain loves ATP, right? I can't go even 3 seconds without ATP. All right, now, what about this mitochondria? What does a mitochondria get out of the relationship? It gets oxygen because the human body is breathing. We're inspiring, expiring all the time. We got this cardiovascular system delivering oxygen to this little greedy guy right here, but that's okay. I don't mind if he's greedy as long as I get ATP from him, okay? But there's something else, too, that's really important. If you're a bacteria, there are all kinds of things that would like to consume you and break you down into its own particles and energy source, right? So there are things that like to predate on bacteria, and so when a mitochondria is inside the cell, it is protected, right? So it gets a lot of protection from the human cell because there's this big, huge system in your body that fights infection, and we call that the immune system, right? So the mitochondria gets a really good deal out of that circumstance as well. So we call that the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. It's really a kind of, you could think of this as a, at one time, was a free-living organism that found a new home inside these cells, and now that it has evolved together to where now mitochondria can't really live anywhere except inside of a cell, And as a matter of fact, our human cells couldn't live without the mitochondria either, because they have evolved together. That's a really interesting way to think about mitochondria. And one last thing, too. Sometimes you have a bacterial infection. What can you take for a bacterial infection to help you out? Antibiotics that specifically kill bacteria, maybe like anthrax or other kinds of bacteria. If you have a sore throat, that's a streptococcus or staphylococcus kind of infection. So you take an antibiotic. Guess what should be in the back of your mind all the time? What do you have providing all of this ATP in your body? Things that at one time were bacteria. And as a matter of fact, pretty much all antibiotics for some people attack mitochondria in them, and sometimes they have really weird circumstances that they have to live with for the rest of their life because that antibiotic that they took for an infection has killed some part of mitochondria that are inside their cells. So you can look up contraindications or side effects of various medications in Google and find out what some of these things are. So that's just kind of underscores how important it is. You shouldn't take antibiotics just because you have the flu, because the flu is a viral infection, not a bacterial infection. You take it, it won't hurt, it won't help you at all because it's a viral infection. And what's the worst case scenario? You could actually be poisoning your body by taking an FDA-approved antibiotic, right? If you're in that rare case where that happens, all right, it's very rare, but if you're that one person out of a couple hundred thousand, that will be a really miserable circumstance. So you got to listen to your physicians, and they say, can't give you an antibiotic for that, there's good reasons for that, right? That's just one of the reasons. Okay, so let's now move on to protein synthesis. Okay, there's something that we teach in beginning biology classes. At least they did when I was in school, and maybe they still talk about this. It's the central dogma of biology. And a dogma is just something that you're told, and you just believe in it. And it's something you don't question. Okay? And so if someone says this is something you should believe in and not question, does that sound like science to you? What does it sound more like? It sounds more like religion. And religion, of course, is very important, right? It's just some things that you don't have to question, you just have this inherent understanding of. Okay, so I'm going to tell you something that's kind of in the gray area between religion and science. Okay, but a place to start is to treat it like science. But you might have to change your opinion as you learn more and more science. Here are three different kinds of molecules in your body. You have DNA, which makes chromosomes. Where do you find chromosomes at? In the nucleus, right? And it's protected. It's really the blueprint on how to build your body, which means then that determines how your body is going to function. So the nucleus controls both the structure and function of cells, okay? And it does that by building proteins, okay? And proteins, if we look at the slide on the left, are all these things in the cytoplasm right here. So the information to make all of these proteins is contained in DNA, and that's the information that's passed from generation to generation. And that is very important information. It shouldn't ever leave the nucleus, because if it does, it could be damaged or destroyed, and then the cell is going to die. So think of the information in DNA inside the nucleus as being the textbook that I have in the reserve section of the library. Right? Very important books that are expensive, that you don't want to have damaged. You put it in a place in the library where people can access it, but they can't take it out. Maybe they can make a photocopy of it, use the information, but they can't take it out of the library so it doesn't get damaged or destroyed. That's the DNA right here. All right, so how do you get information out of the nucleus? It's converted into another molecule called RNA. And as you see, RNA and DNA kind of look similar. They both have three letters in them. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. RNA is just ribonucleic acid. There's just a very small difference in this molecule. The only difference is that DNA really stays inside the nucleus, and that information is copied into RNA, which can leave the nucleus. And if RNA gets damaged or destroyed, what's the big deal? Can you still make more RNA? You sure can, because you can go back to the information in DNA and make more RNA out of it. So RNA is really the working form of that information that's contained inside the DNA, inside the nucleus that's protected. So if we look at protein synthesis, we got these three molecules. We got DNA, RNA, and protein. So this is a process. How many steps does it take to make a protein? How many arrows do you see on this diagram? You got two arrows, so that means it's a two-step process. The first step is converting DNA into information that is called RNA. It's almost the same molecule, right? It's made out of nucleotides. So if we break DNA down, we get nucleotides. If we break RNA down, we get nucleotides. It's the same molecule. All right, and then RNA leaves the nucleus. So let's look at the slide on the right. It leaves the nucleus, goes into the cytoplasm, and then that RNA is used to make a protein on a ribosome. As a matter of fact, the ribosome is made out of RNA as well. It's the workbench. It's really a structure that makes proteins. Okay, now what's the building block of protein? Everybody knew that probably before they took this class. Is it a nucleic acid? No, it's an amino acid. Okay, so it has different basic building blocks compared to RNA and DNA. All right, so that is the second step right here, converting information in RNA into information that makes a protein. Because just like when you spell a letter, like protein right here, right, the P's got to come before the R, which comes before the O, comes before the T, and this word has got to be spelled properly before it has the right kind of meaning. A protein is the exact same way. So, for instance, an amino acid with a certain kind of structure has to be placed first. And then another amino acid with a little bit different structure comes after that. Those amino acids have to be strung together just in the right way to perform its function. And that information, the sequence of amino acids in a protein, is contained in DNA, which exits the nucleus through this process right here. Okay, so this two-step process is what we call protein synthesis. You got to know where each step takes place. The step that converts DNA to RNA, this arrow right here, where does that take place? In the nucleus. And you know that because DNA never leaves the nucleus. Where does this second arrow take place? In the cytoplasm, okay? Because that's where proteins are made, that's where we have ribosomes. So that two-step process takes place in two separate locations inside the body. The other thing that you recognize from this central dogma right here, what about those arrows? What do they look like? Two-way streets or one-way streets? One-way streets, okay? So information in DNA can flow into RNA, and that information can flow into proteins, but information in proteins can't go back the other way to make RNA than to change your chromosomes, right? So another way of saying that is if tonight you go home and have a chicken dinner, you don't have to worry about waking up with feathers and a beak tomorrow morning. Because you just ate a bunch of chicken proteins, that won't affect who you are. That's defined by the DNA inside the nucleus, because protein synthesis is a one-way street. Okay. Now, as we get more sophisticated and you take some classes, you might see that's not an absolute rule, but for right now, just say that's dogma. Don't challenge that for this class. Okay. But for other classes, you'll have to challenge that when you take a more scientific class. You'll say, oh, well, sometimes this happens, and you'll learn about those processes too. Okay. All right, so now we got to know the names of these two processes right here. All right, this first step, going from DNA to RNA inside the nucleus, is what we call transcription. The second step that takes place in the cytoplasm, which converts information from RNA to protein, we call that translation. And you can look those words up in the dictionary and find out why these steps are called that, but we'll talk about that right now just for fun. So the first step right here, DNA to RNA, transcription, you're familiar with that term because you've taken some classes here. Maybe you want to transfer to another college or get a job, and somebody's going to say, hey, I need to see what classes you've taken and what kind of grades you have. All right? And so you go to administration and records, and what do you ask for? A transcript. And what the heck is a transcript? Is it the one copy that administration and records has? Do they give that to you? Because then they don't have anything. They take that copy and do what with it? They make a photocopy of it and then give you the photocopy. So a transcript is really a photocopy. It's an exact duplicate of the information, right? Nothing should change in that. All right, now let's look at DNA. What did we say the building block of DNA was? It was a nucleotide, okay? And the building block of RNA is a nucleotide. It's the same building block. It's the same language right there. So RNA is really a photocopy of DNA. Right? It's just a working copy. If it gets lost, no big deal. Because if you lose your transcript on the way to mail it, all right, what can you always do? go back to administration record and say, oh, I need another copy. And they say what? Okay, another $150 or whatever it costs. Not that bad yet. Okay. So transcription is a way of making a photocopy of something, almost an exact duplicate. Very little difference between RNA and DNA. You'll learn some differences a little bit later on. Okay, and that happens in the nucleus. There are three kinds of RNA. The one that makes the ribosome, the workbench, we call that ribosomal RNA. And what do you need to make a protein? Amino acids. So in order to make a protein on a ribosome, the ribosome has to have amino acids brought to it in order to put them all together. And there's a molecule that transports amino acids, and we call that the transfer RNA. You could call that a taxi RNA if you wanted to help remember, but remember it's really called transfer RNA. It's a small RNA that brings amino acids to a ribosome. And then there has to be a string of information that tells the ribosome what amino acids get placed next to each other to spell the protein properly, right? And that's called the messenger RNA. It's a big, long RNA molecule, which then determines the sequence of amino acids that the ribosomes will make. So those are the three kinds of RNA. Okay, so where are all of these RNAs made? Where are these RNAs made? In the nucleus. In the nucleus. Right, and the basic building block of RNA is a nucleotide just like DNA. Very similar. All right, so that's step one. What's the name of step two? Translation. Let's look and see. What does translation mean first? It means taking information that's in one language, maybe Farsi, converting it into another language, like Mandarin. Now, what about the information? Does it change form? Do you add or delete information when you translate something? No, not if you're going to get paid to do it. If you're a translator, the information is exactly the same. The only thing that changes is the language, right? The words look totally different. Spelling is totally different. But the information is exactly the same. Now, why do we call this translation? Because what's the building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide. It's a nucleotide language, but what's the language of a protein? It is not nucleotide. It is, you knew this already, that is amino acid language. So we call this translation because information is going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language. So that's translation, okay, right there. All right, and that happens in the cytoplasm. And just say for this class, never happens in the nucleoplasm, which is what? All the stuff inside the nuclear envelope, the nuclear membrane right here. Okay, so now you know some things about protein synthesis. How many steps? Two. The first step is transcription. The second step is translation. Maybe you have to draw it out on a piece of paper a couple of times so it's right on the tip of your tongue for the test, but you can figure it out if you got time, right? Okay, so that's what we mean by those two steps. And that's why we have chromosomes inside the nucleus to be protected. And that's why RNA is made, because we don't ever want to take a chance of damaging the DNA inside the nucleus right here. And then the working copy or the RNA comes out, and then proteins are made on ribosomes. Don't forget, there are two places where you find ribosomes. Where are the two places inside the cell? Which means that the proteins that are made will have different fates. You have ribosomes on endoplasmic reticulum, and you have free ribosomes in the cytosol here. Ribosomes on endoplasmic reticulum make proteins destined to go where? Outside the cell through that secretory process. Ribosomes in the cytosol make proteins that will stay inside the cell. They're going to do their job inside the cell as opposed to being secreted. Okay. Okay, last topic, I think, in this chapter, which we talked about already in lab quite a bit, is cell division. Okay, and cell division starts with a parent cell, went into a little bit more detail. I think we even started at the level right after fertilization. What was that cell right after fertilization called? That was a zygote. Okay, we were all a zygote at one point in time. Not a very interesting life form because why? You can't come to anatomy and take notes if you're just a single cell, right? So you need to become trillions of cells in order to do that. And the process of mitosis will take that one cell, which generally we call a parent cell, and then it will divide into two daughter cells. And these daughter cells are identical to each other, and the daughter cell is going to be identical to the parent cell. It's going to have the exact same number of chromosomes. So It's a form of reproduction, but it is asexual reproduction because there's no diversity that's being produced. All these cells are just clones of each other. So you could think of this as asexual reproduction. And there are two reasons for asexual reproduction of that zygote. Why is there mitosis? The first process is for growth so that you can get big. And then the other important reason is for replacement of old and damaged cells. Okay, and when you start to look at some tissues today, you'll look at some blood cells. Red blood cells are kind of funny cells. If we look over here on the right, they don't have a nucleus. So when something starts to go bad with a red blood cell, they just die. They can't repair themselves. So they have a very short lifespan, only about 120 days. Right? And as I said in lab, you lose about between 1 and 2 million red blood cells every second because they don't live very long. And when you start to run low on red blood cells, you call that anemia. So what prevents you from becoming anemic? If 1 to 2 million red blood cells die every second in your body, how many do you have to make? The same number to keep it in balance, right? 1 to 2 million. So mitosis is replacing all of those red blood cells that are dying in your body every second. So very important process. Okay, so you got some phases. Actually, let's look at the whole life cycle of the cell. Okay, the cell life cycle looks like this. Here is the whole life cycle. In yellow right here, or whatever color that is mitosis. All right, so here is the whole cell cycle. You can see that mitosis is just a small fraction of how the cell spends its whole life. Right? Mitosis is just one little part of the life cycle of a cell. Right? The most time that the cell spends is in a phase that we call interphase. Interphase is a growth phase because if a cell is going to split apart, if it's going to start with 46 chromosomes and end up with two daughter cells with 46 chromosomes, those chromosomes have to replicate themselves. You don't want to split the chromosomes in half because one cell will get 23 and the other cell will get 23 when you started with 46. That's not a good thing when that happens. So during interphase, chromosomes are replicated. They start out looking like this little single linear structure, but during interphase, this structure right here is duplicated. We call that replication, right? But they don't separate. They get stuck together, they look like this X right here. So this is the initial chromosome with the other chromosome that was built getting ready for mitosis. That happens during interphase, it's a growth phase. Also, other organelles inside the cell have to replicate themselves so that when a cell splits into two, both cells get the same organelles as well. Okay, so these are all growth phases. And I'm not particular that you know the different phases of growth, but some of you that are more biologically inclined, you might be really interested in some of these other sub-phases within interphase. Now, during these phases, since growth is happening and DNA synthesis is happening, that means that you cannot have condensed chromatin. You can't have DNA in the form of a chromosome. It has to be pulled off of all those histone molecules. It's a long, stringy molecule. In order to get at the base sequence, to get at the spelling of how nucleotides were put together to make a chromosome. And in that circumstance, it's very easy to damage that DNA when it's extended. But what's in the cell, what feature of a cell protects that DNA when it's being used, when it's in that extended form? Where do you find all of that chromatin? It is in the nucleus protected behind the nuclear membrane right here. Not anything that's in the cytoplasm has access to the extended chromatin. So remember, it's like packaged in, okay, it's behind the nuclear envelope right here. It's protected. All right, so interphase, the chromosomes replicate so that you have two copies of every one. Nonetheless, even though you have two daughter chromatids, you have one chromatid and another chromatid attached to each other, you have two daughter chromatids, we still call that one chromosome. But in the back of your mind, you should realize what? You have one chromosome that's been duplicated and now they're stuck together. It's really two pieces of the same chromosome. Okay, when the cell is ready to undergo mitosis, right, the first phase is prophase. And what happens, we have extended chromatin condensing into chromosomes. Now you can see them underneath a light microscope. They've been wrapped around the histones. They're thick enough for you to see. The centrioles start to move to opposite ends of the opposite poles of the cell. And now the cell has entered mitosis, which is that asexual reproduction. So here we have the nucleus with extended chromatin. This is interphase. The DNA can be damaged, but it's protected, but it's used. It's used to make proteins. What's that first step in protein synthesis that happens inside the nucleus? What's that called? The first step. That's called... Okay, you might have to say, well, what happens during that first step? What's made with the first step? RNA is made from DNA. So DNA to RNA, same language. Oh, it's like an exact copy of each other. What's that called? Transcription. So transcription happens in here, okay, with extended chromatin. When mitosis takes place, then protein synthesis stops. The chromatin gets wound up on histones. The chromatin condenses, forming chromosomes. And we can begin to see replicated chromosomes during that first phase of mitosis, which we call prophase. The replicated centriole right here, they split apart, move to opposite ends, opposite poles of the cell. Remember that the centrioles right here coordinate the microtubule system, which is like the monorail system inside the cell. That forms a structure that we call the spindle apparatus because it looks like a spindle on a weaving wheel machine that people used to use to make yarn with. And the kinetochore, the center of these replicated chromosomes, attaches to a microtubule, but they still have just a random arrangement all over inside the cell. They haven't been pushed and pulled yet. So these are all just some things that happen during prophase of that first phase of mitosis. The nuclear envelope also disappears during this time. And it's okay for the nuclear envelope to disappear right now because the DNA is still protected. Because what form is it in? It's in a condensed form. That you can see, right? It's in the form of a chromosome. It's packaged like in a luggage right now, so it's protected. All right, so that's the first phase. The second phase of mitosis, what's that? Yeah, you got to know this for the quiz in lab this week. That is metaphase. That's probably on the next slide over here. Now, the microtubules have pushed and pulled all of these replicated chromosomes right on the metaphase plate or right on the equator of the cell. And you can see that with this nice micrograph up over here where the DNA is fluorescing the blue and the microtubules is yellow color. And then this is a very short phase of mitosis, but it's easiest to see underneath a light microscope because you just see this nice line right here. Now the daughter chromatids, the things that are connected together, start to separate. They become daughter chromosomes. So the chromatids become chromosomes. They migrate to either pole of the cell. We call that anaphase. And then they bump up against the centrioles. They can't get pulled apart anymore. And a cleavage furrow begins to develop. The two cells start to pinch apart. This happens during telophase. And that process of separating the cytoplasm into two daughter cells is what we call cytokinesis. And in this class, please just say that happens during telophase, but realize that cytokinesis might start to begin in other phases and continue past telophase, just depending on the cell line and what's exactly happening in that cell. Another characteristic of telophase is that the nuclear membrane starts to form once again in this region right here. And another thing that happens is the condensed chromatin starts to unwind once again to an extended form, which means that it can start to be used to do what? What is extended chromatin good for? What is it used to make? A couple of different ways of thinking about that. You could think of the big process or just the first step of it. What's the first step that extended chromatin is used for? Transcription. Okay, and if you think of the whole process, you would say protein synthesis, right? Okay, so extended chromatin is used to make proteins. That's the job of DNA. All right, so that's mitosis. In lab, make sure you can understand these pictures right here, know what phase is taking place just by the pictures. But for lecture, you have to know even what's going on. What are some of the significant features of mitosis. You got to know why mitosis takes place and what is happening during these phases right here. Like, what phase does the nuclear envelope disappear in? That would be prophase, yeah. And the cleavage furrow develops under what phase? Telophase, yeah. So make sure you can go back and forth in all these different phases right here. All right, so that's some of the things that I wanted to say about cells. And, of course, don't forget, what is a cell? It's a basic building block of something. It's a basic building block of life, that's right. If you're wondering if something is alive or not, it's got to be a cell. And what are the three key features that make something a cell? It's got to have a cell membrane. It's got to have cytoplasm. Doesn't necessarily have to have organelles, but it has to have cytoplasm. Organelles are a part of cytoplasm in our cells, so it's got to have a cell membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material, right? And now go back and think of a mitochondria. What does a mitochondria have? It's got a membrane around it. Does it have genetic material inside of it? Oh, it does. It has just one single chromosome, and it's got living fluid inside of it. It has cytoplasm. So you could really think of a mitochondria as really being an organism all by itself. And that's why we think it came from a bacteria at one point in time. Okay. All right, so we're going to press on and go to the next chapter, which is not embryology, but is tissues, I believe. So we've done 1, 2, and now we're going to skip 3, go to 4, tissues. We'll give you a little bit of an introduction of tissues, which is a big topic in today's lab, and tissues are covered in the first practicum, so it's okay that we're getting a little jump start on tissues in here, because some of you will have a practicum starting next week. The Wednesday group will have a practicum next week, but the Monday group won't get it to the week after because we had a Monday holiday at the beginning of the semester. All right, so I didn't open up these files, sorry about that. I wasn't sure we're going to get through all of this. All right, so let's go to your textbook, and then we want chapter 4. We want something that looks like images. Good. We're going to put that over here, like last time. And then we're going to go back and open up the text file. So hopefully you printed out the text file that we want to use. So lecture notes. We're going to go to chapter 4. So the study of tissues is what we call histology. That's why I named this thing histology. But let me get this in just a little bit better way to look at it. All right, so we could say study of tissues or histology right here. That's chapter 4. So way back from chapter 1, we took the human body and broke it down. All right, so you got the whole organism. We broke that down into, let me get away from that funny foundry right there with the microphone. Okay, you can take organism and break it down into another smaller level of organization, which we call organ system. And then we can break an organ system down into the various organs that make that system up. And then we can take an organ, now this is where it gets a little tougher, we can take an organ and break it down into its building block, which is tissue. And that's where we're going to start talking about right now. And you can take a tissue and break it down into cells. Okay, so what makes a tissue? A tissue is a group of cells, so it's got to be more than one cell, and all of those cells have to look the same, and all of the material between the cells has to look the same as well, has to have the same structure. And if those cells all have the same structure, what can you tell me about their function? It's going to be the same. So that's really the best definition of a tissue. Cells with all the same structure and function, that's sort of redundant, and the material between the cells all looks the same and functions the same, which again is redundant, right? If it looks the same, it functions the same. Okay. So a tissue is a group of cells with similar structure, function, and material between cells. All right? And histology is just the study of that structure and function of that group of cells. And the nice thing about tissues is that there are only 4 kinds of tissues that make up your whole body. There's only 4. So if you point to some part of your body, I can say, oh, that's epithelium, or oh, that's muscle, or that's nerve, or that's connective tissue. So that's nice that the body is kind of simple in that respect. Unfortunately, there are some subclasses that we have to know as well. There's more than one kind of epithelium, more than one kind of connective tissue, and that's what we're going to look at in this class. So an epithelium also makes glandular tissue, which secretes something. Okay, so we got epithelium is one kind, connective tissue is one, muscle is one, and nervous tissue is another kind. There are three kinds of muscles, basically, in your body, two different kinds of nervous system cells that we're going to look at. Okay, so you don't have to memorize that, but you'll become familiar with that. And we're going to look at some of the functions of these various tissues, like muscle tissue. What do you think the function of muscle tissue is? Movement. It contracts. It's specialized for contraction. And if things are attached to different ends of that muscle, then they're going to be pulled together. If two bones are attached to different ends of a muscle, those two bones are going to be pulled together. And usually it's through a joint or an articulation, something like that. So you have control over your skeletal system. All right. One thing that is not one of these basic kinds of tissues is called a membrane. And sometimes we consider that a tissue, but it's really made up of two different kinds of tissues put together, an epithelium and connective tissue. Usually, if we put two tissues together to form a structure, what do we call that? We just talked about that. So you know, but you got to make the connection. Two different tissues that come together to form something is really an organ, okay? A lot of times people don't think a membrane is an organ, but the basic definition says that it is, but it kind of stands alone by itself sometimes. Okay. All right, so the first tissue, epithelium, some characteristics of epithelium. It covers a surface on the body. So what's covering your body? An epithelium. Your skin, so your skin is part epithelium, exactly right. But it can also not only cover a surface, but it can line a cavity. So if you have a cavity inside your body, like your trachea, which is an air tube, which is bringing air into your lungs, that has an epithelium that lines it. A blood vessel has a lining on the inside. That's an epithelium, but since it's lining the inside, we call it an endothelium. It's just a little deviation in that term right there. But an epithelium likes to cover different surfaces or cavities, like the skin, gastrointestinal tract, and the lining of blood vessels. Epithelium also forms glands. The job of a gland is to secrete something, maybe like a hormone or a digestive enzyme. Another gland secretes something onto the surface of your skin, like sweat, for instance, to cool you down, or even oils, for instance, to help moisturize your skin, keep moisture inside your body. Epithelium, another characteristic, it has very little extracellular material. So what the heck is extracellular material? I just opened up this slide over here. We're looking at an epithelium. Extracellular material is material outside the cell. Intracellular material is what? Inside. So if we look at this epithelium, we see that the cells are very close together. There's hardly any space between them. And so that's a nice characteristic of an epithelium. No space between cells. There is usually a free surface, right, that has nothing attached to it, like the inside of a blood vessel. There may be blood flowing through here, or this could be cells of your digestive tract. There's digesting food moving across this surface right here, but there's really no part of your body right there. Or maybe it's your trachea, your windpipe. There's air flowing back and forth, but there's really not a part of your body. Or this could even be the surface of your skin, where there's what? Nothing out there except air. All right, so we call this the apical surface. Now, going from superficial to deep, okay, inside your body, if this were your skin, this is what we call the basal surface, and there is a basement membrane right here. And the basement membrane, the job of that is just to help attach the epithelium to underlying structures in your body. Okay, so here is an epithelium. Cells are very close together. It has an apical surface, a basal surface. And what about this apical surface? What does it look like compared to the basal surface here? Does it look the same? No, it looks different. What does that mean in terms of function? Oh, in physiology, you're going to learn there's a huge difference in function between this surface of a cell, the apical surface, and the basal surface. And indeed, it's going to have all kinds of different proteins. It's going to have different shape between the basal surface. It's going to have different functions as a result of that. And guess who controls that? What controls the structures on the apical surface makes it different than the basal surface right here? Well, who's controlling that? It is the nucleus right there. The nucleus controls all of that kind of stuff. Okay. All right, what other things are important? An epithelium never contains blood vessels. All right, so here's an epithelium. I see a blood vessel down here. Notice, it's underneath the basement membrane. An epithelium never has a blood vessel. Maybe you've noticed that sometime. Here is a nerve fiber that's going up into a very superficial layer of your skin. Maybe you've run your fingertip over an edge of a piece of paper, and you go, oh, wow, man, I just cut myself with that piece of paper, and I just gave you goosebumps because I'm sure that happened to everybody. And you look, and you're expecting blood all over the place, and you look, and you go, well, that's not even bleeding. Why did it feel so bad? Okay, well, because you cut that nerve right there, but there are no blood vessels in that tissue that you just cut. Because why? Epithelium never contains blood vessels, which means epithelia can never be very deep, cannot be very thick, because as they get thicker, they move farther and farther away from blood vessels that are down below the basement membrane. So even if you look at your skin, which is a thick epithelium, okay, the surface of those cells is too far away from blood vessels to stay alive. So the surface of our skin, those cells have died a long time ago, and they're in the process of falling off your body. But that's okay, because the deeper layers are the ones that are undergoing mitosis, where cell division or proliferation takes place, and those are going to replace the ones that die and fall off your body. What's that process that replaces those cells that fall off your body, that die and fall off? That happen in the very deep layers of your skin. What do we call that process? That is proliferating those cells, replacing those cells that are dying and falling off your body. What's that process called? It's got those four steps to it. Okay, yeah, mitosis, exactly right. And when we look at some skin, we're going to see some cells that are undergoing mitosis in those deep layers right there. Okay, well, that's probably enough for this slide right here. So there's more than one kind of epithelium. And the way that we classify epithelium is by the shape of the cells that make the epithelium up, but also by the number of layers as you go from the basement membrane to the apical surface. In this particular illustration, how many cells do we see from the basement membrane up to the surface right here? There's just one. I just see one nucleus. I see cytoplasm. I don't see another cell on top of another one right here. All right, so that's, you're going to develop an eye for that in lab. All right, so the two ways that we classify epithelium is by shape and by layers. Okay, and let's go to the next slide. So we see that on this slide. If it's just one layer of cells between the basal surface and the apical surface, we call that a simple epithelium. Right? It's not a monoepithelium, we just call it simple. And it even gets simpler than that. If it's more than one layer, if it's two layers or three or four or thousands of layers, then we call it stratified. So there's only two terms, simple or stratified. So here you can see this is a stratified epithelium because there are many layers from the basement membrane to the apical surface. That's one way. Another way is by the shape of the cells. Some cells in an epithelium are flat. They kind of look like a pancake. And the name for pancake is squamous. But that's not really true. Squamous really means flat. Okay? Squamous is just a Greek word for flat, which, think of a pancake, right? That kind of looks like a pancake. Cuboidal looks like a cube. A cuboidal cell is as wide as it is tall as it is deep. It doesn't have to be exactly square, but it has to have pretty much those dimensions. If you look at it from one side, on the top or the bottom, it's going to have the same dimension. All right? A columnar cell is going to have the width and the depth the same, but the tallness is going to be really tall. So one dimension is going to be really big compared to the other two. And how many dimensions do we need to classify space again? Three. Yeah, you got right, left, forwards and back, up and down. Right? Or sagittal, transverse, and what's another? The last plane is coronal or frontal plane. Yeah, frontal. Okay. So when we talk about an epithelium, we combine these terms. All right, so let's combine some of these terms right here. So the way that we use the shape of a cell to define an epithelium, we don't look at the basal surface, we look at the apical surface. So here we see a stratified epithelium, but now is it cuboidal or columnar or squamous? We look at the apical surface, and so these right here are squamous. They're flat, right? And Don't say pancake, I was just kind of kidding. There are certain parts of bones that are flat, okay? And that's not the pancake part of the bone. You could call it that and I would know. That's the squamous part of the bone. Okay, so squamous means flat. Okay, so this is a stratified squamous epithelium, even though these cells down here at the basal level really don't look squamous. Now this right here, these cells for sure look squamous, but is it a stratified epithelium? Obviously not, so that is a simple squamous epithelium. We put those two classifying terms together. Okay. Okay, they also make glands. We'll talk about some glands in a little bit. And in lab, we get to look at some of these different cell shapes. And let's just talk about this slide, and then we can stop until next time. And then over the weekend, I'm going to start to put these lectures on the web because I didn't get a note from anybody saying, please don't do it. All right, so here we have a tube. And you're going to say, well, that doesn't look like a tube, but think of this pencil. Okay, and this pencil is hollow on the inside that's filled with ink, and we could cut this pencil a number of different ways. We could put a nice transverse cut on it like this. We could cut it in half just like this and look at it on end. And what does it look like on end after we cut it with a transverse plane? It looks like a circle. All right, so this tube right here has just been cut perfectly so that it's a nice circle. We could also take this pencil and cut it with an oblique section, and now you don't have a circle. What do you have? You have an oval right there. So sometimes, depending on how these tubes are cut, you see circles or ovals, or maybe it's just going to be a long tube if it's cut exactly along the long axis of the tube. Nonetheless, we can see the basement membrane right here, and we can see the apical surface, and the inside of a tube is what we call the lumen of a tube. And that lumen contain urine, for instance, if it's a urethra. It contain chyme, for instance, if it's part of your digestive tract, or if that lumen is a trachea, then air is flowing back, or if it's a blood vessel, there's blood flowing through the lumen of a blood vessel. So various things can flow through the center part of a tube. So this is the apical surface, here is the basal surface, and here's a nice nucleus in a cell. So if we count the number of cells from the basement membrane to the apical surface, or maybe you're lucky enough to see nuclei there, how many cells do you see? Just one. So is that a stratified or simple epithelium? It's simple, right? And if you look at these cells right here, what is their shape? What is it? Could they be columnar? No. They don't look columnar. What's your best guess? You don't have a nice three-dimensional view. This is just a slice through it. So maybe sometimes it's hard to say that it's not squamous, but if you look at cells like this that are pretty tall, pretty wide, this is a cuboidal cell. So using all that terminology together, this would be a simple cuboidal epithelium. Okay. So we'll look at some other kinds of epithelium. We're going to spend a lot of time in lab. And as a matter of fact, over the weekend, you probably, no matter what lab you're in, you probably want to start looking at all these different kinds of tissues that are in your book. Because these pictures right here are what we're going to take the majority of the practical questions from. So you can use those as flashcards and just begin to recognize what some of these tissues look like. And on the practicum, you might even have to label some of these lead lines right here. Like this is going to the basement membrane, this is going to the epithelium, and the space between the epithelium, that's just connective tissue, connective tissue. Oh, I didn't pass the sign-in sheet around. It's a little late. There's not enough time to do that. So today I won't do it, but next time I'll have to do that. Okay, so I won't know for sure if you're in class or not today. If you really want to sign it as you go out, that's fine, but I can't really use it, okay? Because there's not enough time for everybody to sign it. Okay, have a nice weekend, everybody, except those of you that are lucky enough to have lab yet today.